Well, just as we had a continuum between pregnancy and lactation, so we have a continuum between childhood and adolescence. And the habits established in childhood track into the teen years and on into adulthood. This goes for the good habits, and it goes for those that are not so good. And adolescence is a time of increased independence, and yet family interaction has a very important role to play in achieving nutritional adequacy. Excuse me. The period of growth after puberty is one of rapid intensity that's second only to that in infancy. The nutritional needs are high, and teens need high-grade fuel. Yet their food choices do not always reflect that need, and they're more likely to skip the foundational meal for the day, breakfast. And skipping breakfast appears to occur more frequently as teens get older. And breakfast consumption in teens results in similar outcomes as in younger children. For example, breakfast enhanced the cognitive performance and mood in adolescents, and a higher quality breakfast, and that was one that included multiple food groups, was associated with better mental health scores. But those aren't the only effects. Skipping breakfast in teens, as in children, is associated with lower nutrient intake. And as you look at this list of nutrients that are at risk in breakfast skippers, and by what is included, you can identify various food types that are not consumed in adequate amounts. According to a review of these 47 studies of breakfast and nutritional adequacy, children and adolescents, regardless of whether they skip breakfast or not, have similar nutrient intakes at meals other than breakfast. So that means that when breakfast is skipped, the nutrient deficits are generally not made up at meals throughout the day. The lower intake of calcium and vitamin D in breakfast skippers is especially worrisome among young adolescent females who are the most likely to skip breakfast, because bone accretion is highest during adolescence, with some 40% being accumulated during these years and very little thereafter. A lower peak bone mass is associated with increased risk of osteoporosis, as I'm sure you're aware. But optimal calcium and vitamin D intakes, along with physical activity, are modifiable factors that can help achieve the genetically predispositioned peak bone mass. And we'll not mention each of these nutrients, but we will recognize iron for its importance in the expanding blood volume of developing teens, and we just noted it in its importance in the developing brain of young children. But we'd also note the wide prevalence of iron deficiency around the world. This nutrient, as well as folate, is especially important for females entering the reproductive years. There was a recent prospective study of pregnant adolescents completed in England. It found that 52% had iron deficiency anemia and 30% had low 25-hydroxy-D levels. Somewhat fewer had indicators of low folate status. But when the babies were born, they found that a poor micronutrient status increased the risk of small for gestational age infants in these adolescent mothers. So what we're talking about, again, babies born too small, not because of prematurity, but because of inadequate nutritional support. Now, the relationship between breakfast and nutrient adequacy is quite well established. However, the evidence is less well established between breakfast and body weight. Nonetheless, there are a number of cross-sectional studies that have reported, not all of them, but many of them, report that children and adolescents who skipped breakfast had higher BMIs or body weights compared to those who consumed breakfast. The researchers also reported that the overweight or obese teens were more likely to skip breakfast. Now, this was especially true among females. And in addition to not being hungry and not having enough time, wanting to lose weight was given as the reason for not eating breakfast. Now, we might think, well, those are the teens, but that happens in younger girls as well, before the teen years. Breakfast consumers reported eating more calories, as we just noted, in children, but weighing less than the breakfast skippers. Now, it's possible that those who were overweight or obese underreported their food intake. But skipping breakfast has been associated with an overall diet that is defined as poor or inadequate, and breakfast skippers tend to snack more and on high-fat snacks. Skipping breakfast has also been associated with lower levels of physical activity. On the other hand, breakfast consumption may be a marker for more healthful food choices and more physical activity, so the issue may be somewhat complex. Nonetheless, though there are some remaining questions, a nutritious breakfast with varied food is highly recommended for all ages and all around the world. And I might just mention that in preparing for this talk, I looked at studies from New Zealand, from the Netherlands, from England, Iran, Sweden, Norway, Australia, and more. So there's lots of people looking at this issue. And there is one point that I think is of considerable importance in this context, and that is that parents' breakfast eating significantly predicts breakfast eating by teens. So as we said earlier, teens are becoming more independent, but still there are those familial influences that are important. And further, increased frequency of eating family meals together increased the likelihood that teens made healthy food choices. Now, as I was typing this slide, I looked at what I had written and saw that I had inadvertently left out the S in fast. So it read fat food instead of fast food. Well, I thought that may not be such an incorrect characterization. Fast food consumption increases as the teen years progress, and a recent study looked at fast food consumption, increased calorie intake, weight gain, and obesity risk. And the authors found a positive association between more frequent fast food intake and an increase in total calories or BMI. They found an independent role of fast food in hastening rates of weight gain. And they concluded, sufficient evidence exists for public health recommendations to limit fast food consumption and facilitate healthier menu selection. And this study also noted the importance of family influences on adolescent dietary behavior. And as health professionals and as parents, we need to be sure that other parents, all the parents, are well aware of the very important role they play in helping their children and youth to form good habits. Children are often introduced to fruit juice and fruit drinks very early. Too much of these can lessen appetite at meals and decrease the intake of milk, which provides much-needed nutrients not found in the fruit juices and certainly not in the fruit drinks. As they grow older and enter the teen years, soft drinks often become the beverage of choice. One recent paper that was of interest to me found that long-term low sugar intake was associated with better nutrition intake and growth versus high sugar intake in children from 13 months to 9 years of age. And these children who had a low sugar intake consumed more protein, more fruits and vegetables, grains, dairy products, and ultimately more vitamins and minerals. Now, recent meta-analysis of 88 studies found a strong and consistent relationship between soft drink consumption and increased energy intake. They also found that people do not adequately compensate for the energy in soft drinks by decreasing energy intake from other foods, and so they increase their total energy intake. Their findings also raise the possibility that soft drinks may increase hunger, decrease satiety, or calibrate people to desire a higher level of sweetness that extends to other foods. Now, perhaps a partial answer may be found in the high fructose corn syrup that has been the only sweetener in U.S. soft drinks since about 1970 when it was first introduced. And it's also used in fruit drinks as well as many other products. Although the U.S. is the major user of high fructose corn syrup, it is manufactured and used in many countries. One concern relates to the metabolism of fructose. Now, we're not going to have a biochemistry lesson, but we will say that fructose is processed differently from glucose. And one of the outcomes is that fructose cannot readily enter the brain and provide satiety signals. Another issue is that fructose favors de novo lipogenesis in the liver. And unlike glucose, fructose does not stimulate insulin secretion or leptin synthesis. Both insulin and leptin participate in the regulation of food intake and body weight. Before we leave this topic, we should also note that the fruit drinks that children often consume generally contain apple juice as their base, and over 60% of the calories in apple juice come from fructose. I think that oftentimes parents are giving their little ones apple juice, and often they give it in a bottle. And that's just, you know, a recipe for, I think, some disaster, because certainly for the dental caries, and we're setting up something perhaps with this fructose content. So we can see that there's a number of reasons why many nutritionists and clinicians are concerned with the very high intake of high fructose corn syrup and believe that it may be one of the determinants of the current epidemic of obesity. Again, health professionals together with parents should pay attention to what's in the snack and drink machines in schools and work to add healthy alternatives. And perhaps we need to look in our own refrigerator. The authors of the meta-analysis concluded with this statement, and bear with us as we read it together. Given the multiple sources of energy in a typical diet, it is noteworthy that a single source of energy can have such a substantial impact on total energy intake. And here they said this is reason enough to discourage the consumption of soft drinks. And then they said, the fact that soft drinks offer energy with little accompanying nutrition, displace other nutrient sources, and are linked to several key health conditions such as diabetes is further impetus to recommend a reduction in soft drink consumption. Now, it seems quite pertinent to notice briefly here one of the factors that impact energy output. We really can't look at just input when we talk about nutritional status. We have to include output in our discussion. First, we would remind ourselves that nutrition habits, as well as activity habits, start in childhood and progress through adolescence into adulthood. The cartoon says, did you know the average American kid spends 4.5 hours a day watching TV? Which, of course, means that with all that practice, by the time they're adults, they've gotten really good at it. Well, we might ask, who's the gatekeeper? Who is assuring that our children and teens get the physical activity they need? Who's assuring what they watch on television, what they are putting into their minds? And you notice the scrambled screen here. Not every child can run in the fields and climb trees and so on, but as health professionals and as parents, we need to strongly encourage more physical education classes. And those classes should teach activities that can be continued throughout life. And as parents, we need to assure regular access to physical activities. There have been a number of studies that have looked at media and body weight status. These are among their findings. They found a statistically significant relationship between media use and that included TV viewing and or video computer game use and body fatness in both children and youth. They found a negative relationship with physical activity. And another large longitudinal study included over 7,300 children, and these children were followed from kindergarten age to 10 to 11 years. And after controlling for a number of pertinent factors, they found that the hours of TV watched per day were significantly associated with an increased rate of BMI acceleration from 5 to 6 years of age to 10 to 11 years. Now, the importance of this finding is echoed in another study that found that the amount of TV watched per day at age 10 was associated with a steeper BMI trajectory for the next 4 years. And another found that adolescents who watch more TV are more likely to be overweight or obese. And again, we're reminded of that Helsinki study and others that are concerned with a rapid increase in weight gain in children over 2 and its relationship to coronary heart disease risk. Now, as you know, obesity and diabetes are growing problems not only in developed countries, but increasingly so in the developing world, and especially where there is a nutritional transition from a society characterized by undernutrition to one with lower activity levels. From a society characterized by undernutrition to one with a more refined westernized diet. That is the nutrition transition that is going on in so many countries. And this diet, with its increased fat and energy combined with lower activity levels, is apparently resulting in a rapid increase in body mass in children who had been born at low birth weight and were thin in infancy. And there's considerable concern that this ultimately will result in a large increase in chronic disease, and a number of studies have addressed this concern. We will look at just one example. This is a prospective study from India that followed over 1,500 subjects who grew up in Delhi. The mothers of these subjects had been followed closely from before conception. And the glucose tolerance and insulin concentrations and weight and length or height were measured every 3 to 6 months throughout infancy and childhood and adolescence to 26 to 32 years of age. And when they looked at those who had impaired glucose tolerance or diabetes as adults, they found that they typically had a low BMI up to 2 years of age. They were not overweight or obese as children up to 10 to 11 years of age. So when they looked at their BMI on the charts, it was at any one point not high for their age. But they were overweight as young adolescents, and they had experienced a high rate of body mass gain after 2 years of age, even though if you looked at one point in time on that BMI chart, it was not excessive. But presumably that high rate of gain continued into adulthood. And I think this points out the importance of not looking at just one point in time, but of following growth over time to see what is happening. In the developing world, you see the growth oftentimes drop off to a lower track. But in this case, it was going to a higher track. So, again, we would notice the high rate of gain in body mass and remember what we just saw in the study of TV viewing and its relation to a higher trajectory of weight gain. And we also saw that fast food consumption was related to a faster rate of weight gain. And here we see in a study in India this happening. So researchers today are very interested in these high rates of weight gain after the age of 2 and a potential relationship with chronic disease, especially in those born at low weight and who were small at 2, which, of course, is very, very common in the developing and transitional countries. So we can see a reason for the concern that is expressed today for this combination of events that may predict significant increases in disease in coming years. It appears that at least some of the risk for chronic disease starts in utero and early childhood and presumably continues on through the adolescent years with inappropriate food intake and low physical activity and consequently an increased rate of weight gain. Many studies of obesity show an inverse relationship with intake of nutritious foods and a positive association with foods of low nutrient density. We must give attention not only to quantity, but to quality of the food eaten. Now, one final issue among teens, seen with increasing frequency in the last few years, is that relates to vegetarian diets. Female teens may adopt a vegetarian diet because they want to lose weight, and this is an acceptable dietary approach. Others do so out of a concern for the environment or animal rights. Many of those who do so for these reasons are not aware of the nutritional issues they need to address. We talked about B12 the other day, and I want to share with you a prospective study from Holland that is informative in this regard. This study began with a group of infants whose parents followed a vegan macrobiotic diet, and the subjects have been followed into adolescence with reports appearing periodically in the literature. As infants, they had a greater prevalence of iron deficiency. They had very low serum B12, and their growth staggered from 6 to 8 months. Again, this is that beginning period of problematic nutritional intake. They had some partial catch-up between the ages of 2 and 4 years. But as the researchers followed them, and they were following them very closely, they were concerned what they saw in their growth. And so what researchers don't very often do, they made recommendations to the parents, and they suggested to them that the parents add more oil, dairy products, or fish to the children's diets. And they found then, when the children were about 10 years of age, those who had been following that advice had grown more rapidly in height than those who had not. Now, as adolescents, they appeared healthy. The boys were at the median of the Dutch growth curve, and the girls were just slightly below. However, their bone mass in both boys and girls was significantly less than the controls. Now, we need to remember that in the first 6 years or so of their lives, these adolescents had had a very low intake of calcium, and they had had marked vitamin D deficiency. They had also had a very high fiber intake and a low protein intake. Well, they also found as adolescents that still they had serum B12 levels that were significantly lower than the omnivore controls, and also their methylmalonate was significantly higher, and these are indicative of a functional B12 deficiency. Nonetheless, they appeared healthy, and given that they had grown and appeared healthy, some questioned any concerns about the adequacy of the diet they had experienced earlier. But given reports of cognitive effects due to B12 deficiency, these researchers were able to investigate any possible association between low B12 status and outcomes in a variety of psychological tests. They found there was a significant association between cobalamin status and performance on tests measuring fluid intelligence, spatial ability, and short-term memory. Now, fluid intelligence is very important because it involves reasoning, the capacity to solve complex problems, and the ability to learn. So these results suggest an impairment in cognitive performance that could have an effect on both educational experience and daily functioning. And these results were found even though these subjects had been consuming animal products for a number of years. Now, these are not the only reports of cognitive impairment due to B12 deficiency in early life. The researchers concluded that moderate consumption of animal products is insufficient to restore normal B12 status in subjects with inadequate intake in early years. We must note the statement just published this year that said delay in diagnosis may cause irreversible neurological damage, and this was a paper that was looking at B12 adequacy and deficiency. And so this brings us back to our question, should I be a vegetarian? Should a teen be a vegetarian? Should I as a parent support my child's choice to be a vegetarian? Should I as a health professional support such a choice? Well, to answer that question, I would turn to a statement made by Dr. Tom Saunders of King's College in London, who has conducted a number of studies, many studies, of vegetarians and vegans. He said, "There is no doubt that a properly selected vegetarian diet can meet all of the requirements of growing children, and we might add adolescents. As a general rule, the greater the variety of foods that make up the diet, the better the chances that all the nutrients will be provided. When we limit a certain group of foods, we limit the nutrients that would ordinarily be provided by that group of food, and so we need to take good consideration as to where those are going to be provided." And so here are some recommendations, general recommendations relative to a vegetarian diet. If dairy products are not used, use an appropriately fortified alternate. Now that means a variety of things. That means B12, but it also means looking at how much protein is there, because there are a number of these alternate drinks that are based on very low protein products. And if we are expecting that drink to provide the nutrients that are provided in dairy products, then we need to look for protein. So protein, B12, calcium, vitamin D, all of these should be equivalent to what would be found in the dairy milk. And it's very important to read labels. We have to read the labels. Recently, I saw something on the web that someone had put there, and they were talking about a milk that they were proposing, and they actually gave the recipe for it, but they called it milk. They didn't put any quotes around milk, but it was made from almonds and cashews. And when I get home, I'm going to be writing to them after I do the nutrient analysis and talk about, in the United States at least, you can't use the term milk unless you have provided all of the nutrients that would be provided in cow's milk. It's very important to read the labels. The second recommendation, to provide an identified protein source, to provide nutrient-dense foods to meet the energy and nutrient requirements. And this is particularly important for little ones, for adolescents, to assure adequate energy we may need to limit bulky foods. And there have been reports in the literature of young ones, particularly, who have had too bulky foods and did not meet their energy requirements. So now here is a few more, and as you look at these really are appropriate regardless of the type of diet you want to utilize. So use whole grain breads and cereals, provide a variety of fruits and vegetables, include well-cooked legumes, tofu, and or nut butters regularly, provide adequate quantities of limiting nutrients such as the B12, calcium, iron, zinc, vitamin D by appropriate foods, fortified foods, or by supplements. And I am reminded of a statement by the French economist, philosopher, gastronome, Béat Savarin, who said, "The destiny of a people depends on the quality of its diet." And so we come back to the need for high-grade fuel. Now, if this were your car, it's not mine, but if this were your car or if it were mine, I am sure that we would put in the very best fuel that we could find, the highest grade fuel. Should we do any less for our children and our teens, or even ourselves? Thank you.